Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo.
Tonight's show is going to be a good one. We'll bring you some news and some alternative news, news you don't hear on the mainstream media. And we also have an interview, and our interview was with, his name is Jeffrey Garver, and the name of his book, which he wrote along with Peter G. Brown, is Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. And Leo and I interviewed him last night. Now, Right Relationship is a Quaker expression. Both Peter and Jeffrey are Quakers, and they base the whole earth economy on this right relationship idea and how to make a better world. So that was a pretty good interview, and we also have some news. Let's see what we have here.
We've got a few articles here. I'm just sorting through, so if you just bear with me.
From Press TV, the most complete Earth map published. The U.S. and Japan have published the most complete terrain map of the surface of the Earth, covering 99% of the planet's face. The Aster Global Digital Elevation Map includes 1.3 million images taken by Japan's Advanced Spaceborne Thermal Emission and Reflection Radiometer aboard the Earth Monitoring Terra satellite. Provided by the U.S. Space Agency, NASA, and the Japanese Trade Ministry, the data will be free to download and use. This is the most complete, consistent global digital elevation data yet made available to the world. This unique global set of data will serve users and researchers from a wide array of disciplines that need elevation, and terrain information. According to the BBC, the local level elevation was mapped with each point just about 30 miles apart. The previous complete topographic map of the Earth was NASA's Shuttle Radio Topography mission, which covered 80% of the planet's surface. The previous map was less accurate in steep terrain and in some desert, and NASA is working to combine this data with the newly obtained information to further improve the global map. Terra was launched in December 1999 as part of NASA's Earth Observing System. The three EOS platforms are part of NASA's Science Mission Directorate and the Earth-Sun System that observe, understand, and model the Earth system to find out the way it is changing and thereby better predict changes. So lots of things going on there. Let's see.
I've got a couple of things I wanted to say.
What's that?
Sarah Palin fires back at critics through Twitter. And this was last week that this happened, but I thought it was an interesting thing to see that she, uses Twitter.
Well, she can't say much because he only can put in a few characters in Twitter, so I don't know how much she could be firing back.
Well, I was going to say this. Alaska Governor Sarah Palin used her Twitter page Sunday to fire back at critics, seizing on her a decision to abruptly resign from the office this month and to reboot speculation of an FBI investigation. But shortly after lawmakers, pundits, and political strategists took to the Sunday morning television talk show to call her decision a step down, a political mistake, Mrs. Palin posted several tweets on the social networking website aimed at reassuring supporters that she had made the correct decision. She stated that critics are spinning, so hang in there as they feed false info into the right decision made as I enter last year in office to not run again, wrote Ms. Palin, who has been considered a likely Republican presidential candidate in 2012. few hours later in an attempt to debunk speculation that her pending resignation was linked to a rumored FBI investigation. She posted a link on her Twitter page to a Los Angeles Times article that quoted an agency official saying that there was absolutely no truth that the FBI was investigating the governor. And Ms. Palin also earlier in the day posted a link to a letter from her attorney, Van Fline, which pushed back all allegations saying that her resignation had nothing to do with a rumored criminal investigation that she illegally intervened in the construction of a sports complex in Wasilla, the Alaska town where she formerly served as mayor. But many political figures say that Mrs. Palin's abrupt resignation will haunt her if she decides to run. And then her final tweet on the day was, nobody knows whether it's going to pay off or not. Huckabee's, who's a potential GOP frontrunner, Sunday's called the decision a step down from office a risky strategy. Which said nobody knows whether or not it's going to pay off for it. And that's about it. That's about all I wanted to say about it. There's more to it, but it was fun that she's kind of using
her
page. I thought it was interesting. Yeah. It's becoming such a tool.
Okay. This is by John Byrne. UK weapons inspector who was found dead was writing expose paper. British weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly was writing an expose about his work with anthrax and his warnings that Iraq possessed no weapons of mass destruction at the time of his death in July 2003, according to a report published in a British newspaper. Kelly's death, said to have been a suicide, has stirred controversy and it came on the heels of testimony to the House of Commons about a memo which purported that Britain had sexed up a dossier on Iraq's alleged weapons of mass destruction. A parliamentary inquiry ruled that the death had been suicide, though it also included testimony from a former British ambassador who quotes Kelly as having said, "I will probably be found dead in the woods if Iraq were invaded." The new report says Kelly had spoken with an Oxford publisher several times about a book. He had several discussions with a publisher in Oxford and was seeking advice on how he could go without breaking the law on secrets, the UK Daily Express alleged. Kelly's computers were seized in the wake of his death. He was a signatory to British Official Secrets Act, which allows for the prosecution of those who talk to the press about state secrets and prescribes a more stringent framework for secrecy than in the U.S. According to the paper, he was intending to reveal that he warned Prime Minister Tony Blair that there were no weapons of mass destruction anywhere in Iraq weeks before the British and American invasion, and was also intending to lift the lid on a potentially bigger scandal, his own secret dealings in germ warfare with the apartheid regime in South Africa. The allegations of potential Kelly expose came from a new film about biological weapons being debuted in London on the sixth anniversary of Kelly's death, titled Anthrax War. The documentary aired earlier this year on Canadian public television. Kelly was an expert in biological warfare agents, as well as a former United Nations weapons inspector in Iraq. The deeper you look into the working world of governments and germ warfare, the more worrying it becomes, the film's director, Bob Cohen, is quoted as saying, "We haven't proved there is a black market in anthrax. David Kelly was of particular interest to us because he was a world expert on anthrax and was involved in some degree with assisting the secret germ warfare program in the apartheid South Africa." According to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's summary of the film, Poland was raised in Zimbabwe with a former white regime, has been accused of unleashing anthrax against the black population, who embarks on a journey that raises troubling questions about the FBI investigation of the 21st century's first act of biological terrorism. Cohen's investigation has taken from the U.S. to the U.K., from the edge of Siberia to the In a rare interview, Cohen confronts Dr. Death's Wouton Bason, who headed Project Post, the South African apartheid-era biowarfare program. The network's website adds, Project Post used germ warfare against select targets within the country's black population. Anthrax War also investigates the mysterious deaths of some of the world's leading anthrax scientists, including Dr. David Kelly, the UK's top military microbiologist, the Soviet defector Dr. Vladimir Pestchnik, and Dr. Bruce Ivins, the CBC continues. The FBI claims, despite the doubts of highly ranked U.S. officials, that Ivins was the only person behind the U.S. anthrax murders.
Sorry?
Yep. You have something that you want
to hear? Swine flu quarantine grows at San Quentin. Now, the number of quarantine prisoners at San Quentin has ballooned from 800 last week to 100 over the weekend. To 2,100 over the weekend. That is nearly half the prison's total population of 5,200 men. That, according to Louis Patino, the Communication Director for Health Services, receiver for the California State Prisons. We're assessing the situation continuously, said Patino. This is a rapidly changing situation, and we'll have updates as the time goes by. But Patino told us that the quarantine had expanded between additional prisoners because additional prisoners beyond the solo quarantine block have fallen ill. Although they haven't yet been confirmed as having H1N1, of the prisoners who've fallen ill, 35 are suspected and 4 are probable. The prison is still awaiting final confirmation on the 4 probables. The quarantine includes all prisoners that are found in area of suspected flu. All right, the men that are healthy will be confined to their cells, and the sick individuals will be isolated. No visitors will be allowed during the quarantine. It doesn't say how long the quarantine is going to be, though. So that was interesting.
Hmm. Israel's Lieberman praises Biden's Iran remarks.
Yeah.
This is from Newsmax.com. Israel's hardline foreign minister on Monday welcomed Vice President Joe Biden's statement that Israel can make its own decision about whether to attack Iran's nuclear facilities, calling it logical. But other Israeli leaders avoided comment, a low-key reaction that suggested Israel did not see Biden's comments as a green light to strike against its biggest Mideast rival. President Barack Obama underlined that diplomacy with Iran remains an option. Israel considers Iran a strategic threat because of its nuclear program and long-range missiles. And long-range missile development. Dismissing Iran's denials that it intends to build nuclear weapons, Israel has been nervous over the Obama administration's intent to engage Iran, and Israel has poignantly sent clear signals of its military capabilities while urging world action to rein in Tehran. Meanwhile, the U.S. goal of dialogue with Tehran has been rattled by Iran's heavy crackdown on protesters in the country's disputed presidential election. The Washington says it still hopes the policy will bear fruit. Interviewed by ABC TV on Sunday, Biden appeared to depart from his previous comment that an Israeli attack on Iran would be ill-advised. The White House and Biden's remarks did not signal a shift in U.S. policy. In an interview published by the New York Times on Monday, President Barack Obama indicated the diplomatic option was still viable. We have offered a pathway for Iran to rejoin the international community, he was quoted as saying. Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman's response to Biden's comment was relatively measured. I think he said things that are very logical, he said. Israel is a sovereign state, and at the end of the day, the government of Israel has sole responsibility for its security, future, not anybody else. Sometimes there are disputes between friends, but at the end of the day, the decision is ours, he said. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office has refused comment, underlying Israel's sensitive position on Iran and on U.S. policy toward Tehran. Israel, which is widely believed to have a nuclear arsenal of its own, says it would likely be targeted by Iran based on repeated statements by Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad referring to Israel's destruction. Let's see, a little bit more on the second page. But even Israeli hawks like Lieberman recognize the limitations of an Israeli strike. Israel destroyed Iraq's nuclear reactor in a 1981 airstrike, but experts do not believe Israel can do the same with Iran's nuclear operation, which is spread around the country, some of them hidden and heavily fortified. Israel would also have to take into account the desires of the U.S., Israel's most important political and military ally. The top U.S. military officer, Navy Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, warned Sunday of a danger of an Iranian nuclear weapon and of the fallout from an attack against Iran. I worry about it being very destabilizing, not just in and of itself, but the unintended consequences of a strike like that, he told CBS TV. Netanyahu has been warning about the dangers of an Iranian nuclear program for years, calling for intensive world action to stop it. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak, leader of the Dovish Labor Party, speaks frequently of leaving all of Israel's options open. Israel has sent several military signals to Iran. This week, an Israeli submarine, said by foreign experts to have the capability of carrying nuclear-tipped missiles, returned to the Mediterranean after crossing to the Red Sea in the direction of Iran, a mission seen as a warning. Also, Israel has held Air Force maneuvers that were described unofficially as practicing an attack on Iranian targets. Lieberman, who has advocated radical military responses to a range of challenges over the years, could be expected to beat the drum for an Israeli attack on Iran. Instead, he has voiced a contrasting concern that Israel might be expected to do the world's dirty work by hitting Iran, leaving the world community free to criticize Israel afterwards, as happened after the attack on 1981. During a visit to Russia, Lieberman said, "We do not intend to bomb Iran, and nobody will solve their problems with our hands."
Yeah. So anyway, that's so much for that. The last article I'm going to read tonight before we go to the interview is many people know. This is funny that I had to pull this up from the BBC.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but ex-Pentagon Chief McNamara died. This came out yesterday, but Robert McNamara, who served as U.S. Defense Secretary during the Vietnam War and the Cuban Missile Crisis, has died, aged 93. Mr. McNamara, who served under President John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, was also an architect of the U.S. policy of nuclear deterrence. After leaving the Pentagon, he became president of World Bank. His wife Diana said he had suffered failing health for some time and died in his sleep at home in Washington, D.C. Before taking up the post as Pentagon chief in 1961, Mr. McNamara was the president of Ford Motor Company. I didn't know that,
I didn't either.
Turning the company around in the post-World War II era. He is most closely associated with overseeing the involvement of the U.S. in Vietnam from 61 to 68. Robert McNamara was born in 1916. Born in San Francisco. 1946, he was hired by Ford Motor Company. 1961, he was appointed U.S. Defense Secretary. 1968, he became the president of the World Bank, and in 1981, he retired. Mr. McNamara became, to many anti-war critics, the symbol of a failed policy that left more than 58,000 U.S. troops dead. Even his son, as a Stanford University student, took part in protests against the war while his father was running it. And however, in his 1995 memoirs, in retrospect, it's the tragedies and lessons of Vietnam, Mr. McNamara wrote of his regret over his Vietnam role. He described the war as terribly wrong, owing to a combination of the anti-communist climate of the times, mistaken assumptions of foreign policy, and military misjudgments. He spoke frankly about the Vietnam War with the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 2003 documentary, The Fog of War, which was 11 Lessons from the Life of Robert S. McNamara. And with the U.S. in the first year of the war in Iraq, he became a popular and timely attraction and won an Oscar for the best documentary feature. And bombing was criticized. I'll tell you a little bit more about this guy in a secret. And in 1967, McNamara criticized the decision to bomb North Vietnam in retaliation to strikes on the U.S. bases in the South. President Johnson decided to remove him the following year, offering him the presidency of the World Bank. When he left office, he was the longest-serving U.S. Defense Secretary. In his new role, Mr. McNamara devoted great energy to improving life in rural communities in developing countries. He believed it was a more promising path to peace than the buildup of arms and armies. After retiring in 81, he championed the cause of nuclear disarmament. And Lauren Korb, a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense, told U.S. broadcaster WGBH that he had been brave to admit that the war was a terrible mistake, but it was something for which he was never forgiven, he said. I can't remember a public official with the courage to confess error and explain where this country went wrong. Said Korb, who was a friend of Mr. McNamara. It bothered him for the rest of his life, and people forgot that after he left the Pentagon, he ran the World Bank and did an awful lot in terms of dealing with poverty and hunger around the world. Then he dedicated the rest of his life to trying to do something about the proliferation of nuclear weapons. But it's all been lost because of the Vietnam era. And it's interesting that Jim Mars, who was a great author and an investigative reporter, interviewed McNamara right before he left office in 1968, and he told him.
I asked him to repeat that because I wasn't quite sure that I heard him correctly.
Yeah, and that was McNamara, the Secretary of State under Johnson, who said that. That first, he says, finally the Cold War is over. All right, and Vietnam was a diversion. The Cold War is just the Cold War is a
Russia collapses.
Done. He says in the 70s, he says that now the next thing will be terror. All right. Terror will be a war against terror, all right? He said for the next 20 years or so. He says that after that, he says there'll be aliens. He says the space the world is going to be concerned about space, and this is the program that the elite have, to stir up the public, all right, and get them to spend huge amounts of money on defense.
Right.
Yeah. And that's why we have
to keep the people scared so they can control them.
Right, and that's why.
Remember, it's always problem, reaction
solution. Yeah. And boy, that's the reality of it. Our guest tonight in a recorded interview was from last night is
Jeffrey Garver.
Jeff Garver. And he, his book is called Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. And Lila and I asked him some questions last night about his
book. Hard questions, really.
Because he advocates in his book globalism, you know, a global
solution. And channels,
yeah.
And all this kind of stuff.
And, you know, if you followed our show at all over the many years that we've been on, we are totally anti-globalists and do not believe that this is any way to shape or form to go. So we had an interesting discussion with Mr. Garver last night, trying to gain and some idea as to where his book or where his ideas are. You know, he wants to take the country. And I hope you enjoy that this interview. It's about half an hour. And we'll
informative.
Yeah, we'll be back right after that. So here we go. And let's pray our case first, can I? I think it will.
And Senior Policy Counsel to the Assistant Administrator for Enforcement and Compliance Assurance at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Before joining the U.S. Justice Department in 1989, he was a judicial clerk for the Honorable Conrad Sear in the U.S. District Court in Maine. He received his B.S. in Chemical Engineering from Cornell University in 1982 and a J.D. cum laude from the University of Michigan Law School in 1987. Jeff grew up in a Quaker family in rural western New York. And, boy, that says a lot. He's got a lot to read there about himself.
Yeah. So that was great, Jeff. Thanks for coming on the show tonight.
It's great to be with you.
That's quite a book that you and Peter have written. It's about really changing the world in a lot of ways as we know it and shifting around what Americans think as important, and that's sort of the rugged individual.
Well, I think it's in part maybe a rethinking of that and
mm-hmm.
recalling some other things that are important. Certainly, we associate rugged individualism with being an American in some ways, and
mm-hmm.
I don't know that our vision necessarily gets rid of that. It just puts it in a context where we have to realize that we're living in a world that for the first time is seeing the human economy use up the ecological capacity that feeds it faster than that capacity can be regenerated. And that's
mm-hmm.
a new thing. That's something that we've only experienced really since the end of since the 20th century. You know, so we're just 20 or so years, and you know, this just creates a new situation where the idea of something limited having to be shared is becoming much more important. So we have to look back at some of our long-standing ethical underpinnings and traditions, things like the golden rule,
mm-hmm.
concept of fair sharing, things that are also in us, along with this idea of individual, rugged individualism, you know, and that's kind of what we're trying to get at in this book.
Did you find that, when you said right relationship is interacting in a way that is respectful to all and that aids the common good, I can understand that, but is that the basic Quaker principle here that this book is based upon? Or is there other, I'm not really familiar with the Quaker faith, so, you know, other than they've always been done good work. Can you fill the audience in on Quakerism?
Well, this idea of right relationship is certainly something that practicing Quakers are going from the Quaker religion. What Quakerism developed in the 17th century by George Fox, who was it started to be a professional clergy, and that they were interfering with the message between the individual and God. So Quakerism is really, it's interesting because your first question was about rugged individualism. It's considered a very individual-oriented religion because it's all about the communication directly between the person and God. But it's also very important that it happens in community. The notion of right relationship is really a notion of what is as right, given your understanding of moral and ethical principles and the liberal progressive side of Quakerism certainly looks at the life of Christ as a model, but also is informed by many other things, Buddhist thinking, other religions. So it's a sense of what's right in terms of these moral principles, but also, and this is what we're trying to bring out in this book, other truths that are revealed from science and from other arenas as well. And so in this book, we as Quaker authors, and let me just quickly mention that Peter Brown and I are the main authors, but I want to also acknowledge our contributing authors, Keith Helmuth, Robert Howell, and Steve Segge. We're trying to merge these ideas of that come from our ethical and moral traditions with what we've learned from science over the last 2 years about how the Earth works, how our ecology works, and say these have to be much more prevalent in the way we run our economy.
So, in other words, you've presented a framework, an ethical framework for running the economy. Would that be fair to say that?
It's an ethical guidance system that's also very much informed by science. So,
okay.
We think the economy, especially in this situation I described, and we're in an ecological crisis, along with the more short-term economic and financial crisis we're experiencing. Not to belittle that, because it's important and very serious, but the context, especially if you compare it to what was happening in the 40s, in the time of World War II, when we went through folks seem to agree was the previous economic and financial crisis of this scale, we now have an ecological crisis to deal with. Climate change is a big way that this is being brought home, but it's much broader than that. We're living in a world now where the rate of species extinctions because of human factors is 1,000 times greater than the background rate. You know, we have the number of fisheries, so fish stocks, types of fish in the ocean that have gone to either being fully or overexploited in the last 50 years has gone from about 5% to about 80%. So we're getting some signals from nature that are telling us not only are we do we have an economy that's divorced from some of our ethical traditions, but also from the scientific and ecological reality we're faced with.
But do you believe in global warming?
Well, I believe in global warming. I think the broad consensus among the scientific community, the international intergovernmental panel on climate change, and so on.
Well, are you aware of the weather modification programs that are in full force right now, have been for the last 10, 15 years, as far as the HAARP program and as far as chemtrails, weather modification, these black op programs that have been virtually destroying the world economy, world environment. These things are, and science is coming out. I mean, 400,000 scientists signed a petition stating that there was no global warming.
So they do admit that there is global change. They just don't consider it to be global warming.
It's not based on global warming, and there's evidence that we're actually going into a mini ice age over the last 10 years.
This is so divorced from the prevailing science. I was on another radio show where this came up, and I think people have to be really careful about their sources. I'll tell you one thing that I find interesting to look at is the growing charts for trees and just things that mm-hmm. grow in different zones. And those people don't have they don't really have a dog in this hunt. They're just trying to tell people what will grow in different places, and all that stuff is moving north. You know that I'm a little dubious of claims that we're entering an age of cooling. That doesn't seem to be consistent.
Well, I don't know how it is in San Francisco, but from what we've heard in California, the skies are never blue, nor are they blue here. I mean, we have had so much. so much trouble with this in the last, I'd say in the last since 2003 or more. We haven't had a really blue sky day in this area in years. All right, I mean it's all been manipulated. Every time you look up, you see these military planes running jets, these huge plumes of chemicals. The grounds have been tested. The water's been tested. They found barium and aluminum oxide to be the primary things that are dropping down. They've also found other things such as bacteria, and in some cases some pathogens have been thrown out of planes into these plumes they've found. And there's just overwhelming evidence from everywhere, and scientists, are noting this. But yet, administrations like Obama and the political, international society, all right, are saying, oh no, this is all conspiracy. This doesn't exist. Well, I can tell you, you can look up on any given day here in Connecticut, and all you see are chemtrails. That's all you see.
But let's get back to the topic of climate change, and I know that there is controversy about global warming, but let's agree that there is climate change, and that causes a problem for the species that are here on this planet.
Yeah, and then you get these governments like China, okay, that pollute the hell out of their country, okay, and they're not involved with any environmental treaties or anything else.
So we have a big slope to climb. How are we going to climb this slope? I guess that's what we have there.
Yeah, how are you going to get China to stop polluting?
China's a big challenge. On the other hand, I think a big part of the ecological problem we're facing, whether it's climate change or just the overall ecological footprint of the human economy. Most of that footprint up to now has been due to developed countries like the United States, and so part of what needs to be worked out is a notion of fairness in terms of who's going to bear the brunt of what needs to be done. I mean, people talking about in some places. Those who cause the problem that exists today have some responsibility to take care of it. I mean, the other thing that's happening in China is they have terrible pollution problems.
Oh, awful.
And labor conditions that we wouldn't accept. That's certainly true. I mean, and by the way, that's our footprint because we're huge importers of the products of that. So we're somewhat responsible for that. You know, it's their choice to offer that possibility to.
I don't think so. I mean, yeah, they're giving them a dollar. Three quarters of the Chinese are living on less than $2 a day, all right, in wages. I don't think it's the United States, okay, that is paying them. I mean, those wages or allowing that to happen. I mean, the government of China is allowing.
But we want to consume that stuff.
Why not? Why not? Of course. I mean, that's what it's all about. But the thing is it's up to China to say, hey. You know, we can't breathe here anymore.
Well, they create the conditions. That's absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. A lot of countries
want to have our foot
down there because they see that as their way to develop. The problem is we don't have right now an ecological capacity. We don't have an atmosphere that's going to withstand the kind of development that's forecast. And when a lot of the problems, what I'm saying is a lot of the problems in China are in part caused by our consumption.
Yep.
You know, by our pattern of consumption here, because we have a huge trade deficit. That means that every place that is we're importing from, we're contributing to. We're only part of it though, because they also have to time.
You know, quite frankly, I don't feel bad about that. All right, I don't feel bad that we are. I don't see us contributing to that problem.
I do.
You know, the only way that these global concerns seem to be able to survive is by selling to the United States. All right. Economically.
It's the corporations that have gone
United States is the main.
Well, we've allowed that to happen, and corporations are soulless entities. They're not people.
We have allowed it. I mean, they've given us everything we want on the backs of all these other people. So, you know, but they've created these global nightmares in China and Indonesia and wherever else they've polluted everything.
Well, what we tried to put forth in this book is a governance framework that would just put a lot more emphasis on measuring and assessing the problem that we're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
Measuring,
first of all,
what the bioproductive capacity of the Earth is and how much we're using it, and then coming up with a fair way of distributing that. And this is very different from the approach that's being driven by a paramount concern with economic growth. And most of us just take for granted that things are going well when economic growth is going up and things are seriously wrong when they're not. And what a lot of people don't realize is this is a very recent political project. It wasn't, even the idea of economic growth being essential to progress was developed around the Second World War. It became the dominant political objective of most countries only around 1960, and it's a pretty inaccurate measure of well-being. It makes a lot of assumptions. I'll just give you one example. The oil that was spilled from the Exxon Valdez contributed more to GDP by being spilled because of all the emergency response teams, the lawyers' fees, and so on, than it would have contributed had it reached its end point in the market.
You know, that was never cleaned up.
Oh, it's still not clean.
It's never been cleaned up. The Indian tribe.
The Alaskan tribe.
Were supposedly won an award for several $1 billion, of which Exxon has refused to pay and still is going in court and having injunctions and everything else.
Well, the Supreme Court reduced their punitive damages award from, I think, $2 billion to $500 million or something.
Yeah, they're still not paying it. You know, and it's a sick joke. And until you can straighten out the courts, until you can straighten out the collusion and the corruption between the governments and the oil companies and all of these other Walmarts and everybody else, okay, who seem to have a stranglehold on economies, you're not gonna straighten this out. There's no utopia here under these concerns, and you can't. The last thing you can do is give global rights to some agency, okay, to regulate these things. I mean, that's a joke. We've seen that in the UN. It's a total and useless.
On the other hand, we've seen in the United States. The environmental movement that came to life in the 60s and 70s, that was all about realizing that the problems that people were seeing then, like the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland regularly bursting into flames because of the oily chemical.
Well, how about nuclear power? We're still throwing spent nuclear waste into our deserts and into Utah and Arizona and so forth.
By
our nuclear power.
Okay, what I wanted to say there is that what we realize in the United States is that state and local governments couldn't manage the problem. You needed to have national rules. And I don't understand why that basic idea can't translate to the international level. It's done so in Europe, where countries have certainly are very protective of their cultural and national identities. At the same time, they realize that economic integration had to have integration and harmonization of their environmental rules in order to keep a fair playing field. And there's also there's some adjustments made between the more developed countries and the less developed countries to make sure that the playing field is fair. For certain problems that are global, I don't see how we can't have international rules, some kind of a system for measuring the scope of those problems, and we don't put enough resources into that, and then also having a system for enforcing it.
You have the World Bank, the IMF, the WTO, you've got the UN, right, and every other sub-splinter, environmental group that's out there. But I don't understand why there should even be considered one global governing body, okay, to decide who and what is violating and who is what is doing anything, because we've proven that the UN is a corrupted organization, all right, has been for years, and it virtually does nothing, okay, except send out this resolution or that resolution, which nobody pays any attention to anyway.
Well, we have ineffectual systems in place for certain things, and others we have, the World Trade Organization, when countries want to give up their sovereignty and subject themselves to find the penalties at the international level, they know how to do it. There's just resistance to doing that on in the areas that are increasingly going to matter, and like with climate change and other ecological concerns that are now global in scope. So what we propose in this book is we only want to do that to the minimum level necessary, but given the situation we're in ecologically now, it's become necessary to do that, and we need to have those systems.
Another corruption
that we put forward is the idea of a trust, where trusteeships have a paramount obligation to protect the thing they're entrusted to protect. That's not generally the kind of thing we put in place to protect. And we don't have that now for the oceans, for the atmosphere, and there are interesting models that we think should be developed much more. That will try to insulate governance of those global commons in a way that's going to try to keep corruption at bay. It's not easy to do, but right now our global economy and hence our global ecosystem are being run by a power elite, by major banks, by the currency speculators,
who's going to stop that? Who's going to be the global court? Okay. Who are we going to give the rights to over our
ocean and
over our sovereignty? Okay, to Holland? Okay, like they did in the EU? All right, or to some?
Would you like to join us, 210? Hello. Hello. 210-355. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Hey, how are you? What can we do for you?
Well, I listened to your show.
Yeah. What'd you think?
I was listening to had some interesting points, I think. The UN, okay, well, as far as, most organizations like that, they're all corrupted, okay, Governors, too. They're just a fad. I mean, to a point anyway.
No, what I was getting at with this author was that, in his book, I don't know if you've read or heard about his book, but The Right Relationship, but he's trying to create a Quaker utopian society here, using Quaker concepts to globalize the world economy, I just had a lot of difficulty with that concept because, as you said, anything that we've done, in concert with the rest of the world, or other nations, has been a failure. Primarily, any kind of institution we've tried to develop. I mean, the UN is typical of that. But all these treaties, I don't see us winning in any situation in a global. In any kind of global court or any kind of global agency, if you will, regulation.
Yeah, because the UN, it's like they really, I see what they do and stuff, but they don't I don't think they can really enforce anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because
everybody's
got to agree, and then you've got to say United States, Russia, and China, someone's going to have veto power, we're okay. It's really hard to enforce anything,
right.
And they all got to agree on it, so that's the main problem.
And if they do create a global court, or they do create a global agency or a regulation agency, then what we've created, what will be created is a global dictatorship, because they'll be able to dictate the terms for anybody's economy. Oh, you can't produce that much, or you can't burn that much coal, or burn that much oil, or do you know they could dictate anything, right?
That does happen, you know, I guess, but I don't know how many countries would have let that happen to them, you know, I mean.
The EU, the European Union, what happened there is that when they took over, that was kind of a bloodless revolution, as they superseded all of the national, all national authority, all sovereign authority of these countries. Regarding commerce and defense and everything else, and what they're trying to do is they're trying to create this North American Union here in the United States with Russia. No, I'm sorry, with Canada and Mexico, and create a one hemisphere economy. Just like they're done in Europe, and what they're trying to do, and so they're trying to create the South African Union, as well as the Asian Union. So they're
planning. I was never quite sure how the EU came about myself, you know. So I have no history about on that. No, but I don't think that's good. I mean, I don't think it should be one organization that overrides the country's rules, you know, or state's rules, you know. That I don't think that would be a good thing. And a lot of countries have to give up a lot of power too.
Yeah.
You know, I guess on our side anyway. I don't think Americans want to go with it. I don't think our country. You never know with Obama. Who knows what he's going to do? But you know what I mean? He's a wussy. He may just fall into that. But I don't see a.
You know, I fear him giving up our sovereignty. You know, just to appease Russia or appease you know China.
I think he would give up a lot, a lot of stuff, just to, give it up, and he might actually think on their side they might follow through with it. You know what I mean? You know,
yeah.
You know, he might be that naive. I'll give you an example. Something what you're trying to talk about. I live in Texas, okay, and what happened is that this one, the illegal, he was convicted, okay, of I think murder and rape. Not quite sure, and he's gonna be sentenced, right? And they came in, and this was Bush also, he's supposed to have an international treaty, right, you know, supposedly, okay, where he had to have diplomat there, okay, I'm not quite sure. So, this big, and Bush wanted this diplomat thing to go by, right, and well, you know, Texas went down and said, you know, we're Texas, okay, and we don't got to listen to this world court thing, you know, that's
right.
Not us. And they went down and enforced Texas law, and they executed him, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, we don't got to go by your rules, and we didn't.
No, it's the same way around the world. I mean, you know, China doesn't listen to our laws, and I mean, look at South American countries. They don't listen to us. Nobody listens to us, really, unless we go in there and bomb the hell out of them or something. I mean, that's basically.
You're right. Well, you know, but they don't have to. You know, as far as our laws and stuff, they don't apply over there. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
I mean, I wouldn't listen to. So they really don't have to. I don't like it a lot of times. I'm like, because I think sometimes we stick our nose in the country's business where we shouldn't, you know, and try to tell them what to do.
Sure, but to you,
it's like, I'm not sure what's going on with Israel right now. Apparently, they have a thing where they can't build, they can build, though, and I think the U.S. says you can't. It's like, hey, you know, it's their country. You know, if they want to build, let them build. That's their decision, not ours. You know what I mean?
But
that's all.
They're building the land. But the problem with the Israeli situation in the Gaza, as well as anywhere else in the West Bank, is that they're not supposed to be building by law, by international treaty, and by the peace accords. They are not supposed to be building there anymore. And
yeah, but they're probably going, hey, why should we have to listen to that treaty, you know? We're Israel. You know, I mean, hey, why, you know, we're not, that's the international court thing. Why, you know, hey, you know, we've got our own thing here.
It was with Israel. It was with Pakistan, with the Palestinians, and the Palestinian that agreement, okay, is constantly being brought up because they're constantly violating it. All right, both sides are violating the agreement, but primarily the Israelis are constantly constantly making advances on Palestinian land, all right, and encroaching on this and creating illegal settlements. And then on top of that, they're bulldozing existing homes. They're causing incredible problems within Palestine, and they're trying to kick all Palestinian people out of Israel, and that's exactly what or out of Palestine, and take over the land. They've been doing that since 1948, and they haven't stopped.
Where are the borders? I mean, is Palestine because Palestine's not its own country, right?
Yeah.
They're not its own country. They're like a I don't know. See, I've always been confused about this. Okay, I know Israel is there, and I hear Palestine. They want like their own state, supposedly, right?
Okay.
And the Palestinian state, they would like to have their own country. I believe that's their ultimate goal, or one of them, right?
Yeah, Palestine is an occupied state. That's understood. All right.
Now, right.
They're occupied. They do not have their government. Their elected government actually is the Hamas. And
yeah.
The world does not recognize them, okay, as the or else Israel and the United States, I should say, do not recognize Hamas as the rightful government in Palestine, even though they were democratically and overwhelmingly elected into office.
Yeah, I remember that happened. Democracy always doesn't go the way you want to go, right? Because I think the United States wanted to get in there and get. You know, more of somebody we more favorable to, but they elected Hamas instead. You know,
the only reason they're in there is because you have a Jewish operated press, you have a Zionist president, you have Zionist congressmen, and people want to there's something that Israel has carte blanche with the United States, okay, and why they do. I don't know, okay, because they shouldn't. And hundreds of millions of people in this country believe the same thing. We don't know why we're putting up with Israel, all right? But at the same time, Israel has no rights at all whatsoever to violate Palestinian human rights, okay? None whatsoever, all right? And anyone who states that they do are going against all human rights agencies.
Well, how exactly are they violating Palestinian human rights? I know you said they're building the property or they're on disputed land, but how are they? What are they? Because I mean, it's kind of working both ways. Because it isn't like Palestine, they're like constantly fighting almost every time you hear about Palestine and Israel is fighting somehow, you know, or there's something going on there, some sort of friction, some sort of. Or just getting ready to burst open.
Well, look at—I mean, what they've done, what they've created there is a military state. I mean, you essentially they've built these 40-foot wall container walls all around Jerusalem, all around the major cities.
Yes.
Palestinian highways refused to allow Palestinians to ride on the highways. Cut the Palestinians off from their own farmlands. From their own backyards, okay, even. And they've created these huge wall, this huge 40-foot retaining wall to barriers, okay, to separate Palestinian areas from Israeli areas within the same city, even within Bethlehem or within any of the cities. They've cut them off.
Aren't they doing that, like, because I mean, they every once in a while, like, they'll get a suicide bomber show or something like that. You'll hear that. Aren't they, like, doing that to, I guess, for their own, I guess you could say, defense to point or to create their own country?
It's a land grab, is what it is. You got to remember, Palestine doesn't have a military. They don't have any military aid. They don't have even an established government to speak of, okay? The one government that the world recognizes is the Fatah, and the Fatah is nothing more than a bunch of appointed U.S. and Israeli appointed officials. Okay, and they do not speak for the Palestinian people. So it's like, no matter where you go, no matter what you do in this world, you're going to find these horrible encroachments. All right, and what I'm saying, getting back to our friend's book, it just I don't buy that that this world is in any shape now or in the near future for any kind of global government. In 1 second, we have about 9 seconds remaining to the to the stream. If you wanted to call in, if not, I'll be replaying the thing after this. So we're now not streaming. So what's your name, by the way?
I'm the Boogeyman.
Boogeyman.
My handle. I just I don't know if that'll ever at least not in the near future. Because I mean, unless people are so, I don't know, driven in by the media, who knows? Okay, I mean, because you know our media has been so filtered. It seems like recently, you know, you hear more. You're more like Michael Jackson. You know, I hear more of Michael Jackson than other news. You know, what's going on in other, you know, let's say like North Korea, what they're doing, you know, news like that, I think is a little more important than Michael Jackson to me.
But Jackson has become the great diversion because look at the things that have happened in the last 2 weeks. Look at the things that have happened internationally in the last 2 weeks since Jackson took over the news, okay? Iran had a huge uprising, okay? Mm-hmm. China... I had a huge uprising, and they murdered 156 Muslims, right?
Yes, right.
Recently. That's China, okay? Obama, his health care plan and his stimulus plan, everything else is going to hell in a handbasket, okay? The economic indicators, including the unemployment indicators, are skyrocketing, all right? And we have there absolutely is no good news out there for anybody, right? And
yeah. So I understand what you're saying. You know, this you're right. These things happen conveniently. Maybe they're over, the media is just really over the plane. You're right. This happens very so often. They'll time something, and I can't say time this, you know, because the guy died. But you're right. He's definitely because you know this works out in the administration's favor. I think because if people are distracted to Michael Jackson, they don't hear. You know, the real, because I heard the statement, which I kind of thought was a little more crazy, outrageous. They had, like, an analyst, I guess, or someone they invited, okay, and he said for the, the healthcare thing trying to pass, or whatever, they said with under the Michael Jackson thing, it was better, okay, that went into this, okay. In other words, he said it's better that the people never heard about it, sure, you know, when it was passed. He said, under this, I guess he called it the Michael Jackson blackout. He said, the guy actually came on TV and said it was better, which is basically saying, you know, it's better that people don't hear about it as much, which is a crazy statement almost itself. And the thing about China, that's been going on for a little while, and I heard the first mention, it was only like a real small thing, like about a half a minute, not even that, they just mentioned that the uprising was going on, and that's the first time it came off on MSN, you know.
Yeah.
At least by me anyway, or anywhere that I heard, okay, I knew about it, you know, because I pay attention to the sources of the media. But that the first time they reported just for a second, and that had reported ever since Michael Jackson was on. You all hear about Michael Jackson and his life and stuff. That's not you're right. He's a diversion, and he's a very great diversion. And this something's working out very well for the administration. I don't think it's working out well for us, but it's working out well for them.
You almost wonder if they could have caused his death just for the diversion that they needed for 2 weeks.
Wouldn't that be crazy if they went that far?
No, but look back in 2005. Remember when he got into that child molestation case? All right.
Yeah.
It was a blackout of media again for 3 weeks or 4 weeks.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. You know this. If you want to hear something else that goes on, I've noticed, and. Every once in a while, you know the swine flu supposedly, okay? They won't call it swine flu, but you know what I'm talking about, right? There was a thing that came out that said there's like 500,000 Americans that are infected, right? And this timing is very coincidental. It happens every so often, you know, when things aren't so good. And here's the thing about that, no way in the world, because I saw the report when it came out. I think it came out from, I'm not quite sure what organization it came from, some sort of these medical organizations. And they said, okay, these are cases they believe weren't reported, okay? They had no way of knowing, assuming it, okay? And it's like, there's no way in the world. It also says only 125 deaths. So you got a disease that has only 125 deaths, okay? I mean, I don't think the common cold has 125 deaths, you know? You know, if I say this is a thing that will happen every once in a while, I think, and they'll just time it perfectly and distract the people. Because all they'll talk about is you got to wear your mask and all this stuff. I live in Texas, okay? And ain't nobody's even fazed, okay? We just go about life our own business, and we might, you know, do everyday precautions, which you would do when the regular disease shows up. And it'll show up, and they'll distract the people, and they'll try to scare the people. And then something will be going on. They'll pass a bill all of a sudden or something that's not popular. And I just noticed this. And it even goes back to the Bush administration, this little tactic, because I'm not as favorable. I was very critical of Bush administration. Still not a fan of him. But what I'm trying to say is, if you remember, they always had a terror alert, right? And it always happened at convenient times, too. Very conveniently. And it was, people were distracted for a while. And something would be passed. Something would happen, okay, and the people were distracted because, you know, you got to be at war with terrorists and stuff, and, you know, and it was a distraction. And if you look back, it was timed, the timing of these different alerts and terror outbreaks supposedly were basically at key times, okay, for the administration where they needed distraction, something wasn't going good. It's the same thing. It's the same old, same weapon, just a different administration, you know, I guess you'd say.
Well, what I wanted to do is I wanted to finish playing this interview. There's only about 10 minutes left of it. And if you want to hold on, we can talk after that. Is that all right?
Sure.
Or if
sure.
you hang up, we could do that. But we will. I'd like to just finish playing this with Jeff Garber. So, hang on.
Third world country in Africa. Okay, suddenly some little guy is going to be like, you know, the guy like Kofi Annan, you know, suddenly become president of the United Nations. Okay, you know, one of the most corrupt presidents we've had. All right, and yet nothing ever happened to that man. All right, and on top of that, I mean, what have we got to look at as far as international organizations? What do we got?
We got the
International Monetary Fund, the World Health Organization, the World Trade Organization. These guys are all corrupt. These guys are all all the things that Clinton did and Bush did over the last 15 or 20 years, okay, has done nothing more than secede our powers, or cede our powers rather, over to give away our sovereignty to these banks and to the trade organization. Where our
what protection would we have against that?
Nothing. Nothing with the idiots that have been negotiating this stuff now. All right.
Well, I think we have to, you know, with corruption and throwing our serious, but I think it's important to put in place those models so they're to develop them so they're ready when we come up with effective ways to deal with those. You know, you're certainly right that we're not very close to a place like the United States giving up sovereignty, and yet I think you know, we're persuaded, us as authors, because we're not necessarily keen on this idea of having global institutions and global courts and things like that. But what persuaded us, first of all, is that you have an elite that's kind of running the show anyway. If you look, read about the history.
Yeah, but is that okay to have that happen? No.
National Monetary Fund, they're designed to keep the debtor nations in debt perpetually. And set up a system that allows their natural resources to be
exploited,
serving the rich countries. I mean, it's kind of locked into place,
it's always going to happen. You're not going to have that change. You need a complete and total world transformation, enlightenment, okay, if you will, before that could ever possibly happen.
Well,
and the only person, and I wouldn't even trust him, the only person I would trust as the governing global guru, okay, would be Christ. I don't even think I'd trust Christ up there because, he would be too much of a separatist, you know. A fundamentalist. So I think you'd have to deal with too many religious factors. So, like, I don't think you have anybody who could possibly take over that kind of position and really do justice.
Well, in this country, in the United States, we decided we're going to be a country.
You gotta,
not a friend or not a humans. And I think you know, we have a strong confidence in that approach. And I think
what
we're talking about is really applying some of that at the international level. And if the alternative is just to let the status quo, where we just have this overheated economic engine running away.
I agree with you on that. We can't continue to create the way we are.
Not in terms of increasing violence, in terms of the rich becoming more and more enclaved and arming themselves against the poor. It's a really pretty ugly scenario, and I guess we're trying to offer something.
I guess I wouldn't trust the people that are in power to not take advantage of any kind of global situation.
We're now looking at a global tax on this cap and trade. This is all a global tax. And I mean, it's insane how much this stuff is going
to
cost.
To take your idea of a right relationship and build the whole earth economy and pervert it. That's what I would be worried and concerned about.
I'm worried and concerned about that as well, but I think what motivates us in writing this book is to try to put together a more hopeful vision, because we certainly know that business as usual, given the institutions we have now, is heading us towards disaster.
We agree with that.
That's what this book is really about.
There's got to be something and some way to make it happen, but it ain't going to be global. It's going to be a national
grassroots. Starting with the individual.
I would trust nobody on a global scale with directing this scenario. It would globalism, then the global domination and dictatorship is just what we're looking at here, and that's something that I don't trust. The existing world enough. I don't think we've evolved enough, all right, as a race of people to embrace this kind of idea. As utopian and as nice as it may be, I just don't see it under the system we have and the kind of people and politicians and interests that we have in this world. Maybe 50 years from now, after we have an economic and environmental crisis or collapse, people will start thinking about it. But
well, I think you can look at the experience in the United States where it took time to realize that you needed, for certain things, you needed to have federal rules, and of course there was resistance to that as well. And of course they don't run perfectly, but our national environmental rules have done a lot to improve the environment in this country. You also have the example of Europe, which has started with a project in economic integration, and it slowly led to the creation of European wide rules on things like the environment. I mean, the tragedy of the commons tells us if we don't come up with some system for putting on constraints, then local actors, individual actors, are collectively going to destroy the ecological base.
I agree, but look what George Bush did inside of 8 years. He set back the environmental advancement movement by 70, 80 years, back to where we were in before the Great Depression. He's polluting everything, Anwar and you name it. Okay, anything he could do to rape and pillage the resources of our country, and he was willing to do.
There's a lot of damage to be undone.
And his running of the EPA and the FDA and everything else.
Are you interested in getting involved in politics, or getting involved where you could affect change that way?
I have friends that in government that I'm staying in contact with them, and I've been in government. Actually, writing this book makes me want to. My plan is to go back to school and head towards teaching, getting a PhD.
Where you could really affect change for the next generation if you became a teacher, or a professor on the university level.
That's certainly something I'd be interested in doing, and certainly I welcome the opportunity to talk to folks like you and doing radio interviews and getting these ideas out. And you certainly are raising concerns that I think a lot of people have, and you know, we got to work these through because I'm convinced that our current trajectory, our current path, as my fellow authors are, is taking us in the wrong direction. And it's inconsistent with our basic ethical and moral principles. It's inconsistent with what science tells us about how the Earth really works and how our economy has to fit into that. You know, so that's what we're all about here, trying to raise awareness and collectively find a different way forward.
Well, we really appreciate your ideas and what you have to say.
And those of you who want to check out his book, it's called The Right Relationship, Building a Whole Earth Economy. And worth a read if you're interested in what he has to say. It's quite a
It's a very interesting book, and there are a lot of questions, of course, that we had, and I thought you answered them for us. And
more answers at www.moraleconomy.org.
Moraleconomy.org. Okay. Well, we got that. Well, we want to thank you very much, and
I hope you come back and talk with us sometime soon.
Have a pleasant evening.
You too. Thanks very much for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Jeffrey. That was Jeffrey Garver.
Moraleconomy.org.
Okay, that's the end of that interview. And are you still there, Boogie?
Still here.
Okay. Thanks for letting me finish that. So essentially, that's it. I don't believe in global anything.
I agree with you.
I think we have to stay and keep it national, and look out for our best interests. Of course, we don't have to harm anybody to do that, but we have to defend ourselves in order to preserve our nation and our values. So I think that's what this is all about. And before I give away any iota of my sovereignty to what little we have left as people in this country, is totally out of the question. I think this would raise hairs with not only Democrats but Republicans and Independents around the world, throughout the country anyway. That the last thing we want is another global mediating agency like the UN.
Yeah, I think a lot of people in the States think the same. You know, we were the Democrats, Republicans, Independents, or whatever they do consider themselves as. I mean, nobody wants to be told to do some, you know, by somebody else from somewhere else. A lot of people have problems with the federal government coming in and doing it, you know. But it's like I know they do, believe me. In Texas, they do in a big way. If it tries to overextend its power anyway. I see that happening a lot here lately with both administrations. I mean, there's nothing wrong. I mean, government's okay if it's kind of like, you know, kept in check. I think we just got to, you all got to criticize your elected officials no matter all the time, I think.
Well,
all the time. Every second, because a lot of people just give a chance. You don't give a chance, you give a chance. I mean, they'll just go on their own. You can't give a chance. You all got to criticize them every single day, I mean, all the time.
You gotta,
no matter who they are, if it's you like, I mean, Obama.
Yeah, but that, your buddy Perry, Governor Perry is a real fruit loop as well.
Perry, he is not really Perry, okay? I don't really like him as a governor, okay, because I think he's too much into
too much into himself.
Big corporations. I think he's been bought out, okay, to a point by insurance companies. But these type of companies myself, so I think he serves them more so than the people. But it'll serve people conveniently, you know. I know LASIK laws have been tailor-made for a fact in Texas by politicians toward big companies, okay? By Perry in a big way, especially I know that. He's going to be in a fight this time around because he'll be going up against Hutchinson, okay? And she's a very, very popular senator in Texas, among Republicans anyway. And the Democrats, they're not going to win. Not Texas. I'll tell you right now. Because the primaries will come through, first of all. But I live in Texas. I'm a pretty Democrat, by the way. And I think more along those lines, the Democratic core values, that is. And but the Democrat, that's why Texas is more of a conservative state, I don't see it happen. It might happen, okay, but your real prominent politicians are all Republicans, you know? Big yeah. Willie, you should say. There are, you'll get other guys, lower guys, but, you know, somebody wins the Democratic primary, but I don't know, I don't think a person can go on to win the general election, the way the state is set up anyway.
I wish you luck down there, but we're gonna put an end to the show now. But I want to thank you for calling. Do you have a program yourself or?
No, I don't. Everybody's been asking me. I probably should get something going, right?
Yeah. You really should. No. You really should. A talk show.
That was a very interesting interview. Very interesting interview. I really enjoyed listening to it.
I think you should set up a talk show on Texas. that would be unique in itself. Texas politics. Yeah.
Texas politics, they have their own way of doing things. And I can tell you one thing, they do not like being talked for. They don't like the federal government telling them anything what to do, period. End of story. They do not like it. When they start overreaching the powers, they don't like it, especially Republicans.
Right.
And but there is one state that they'll identify with a little more than the others, Alaska, you know, because it's also a very big state, you know. It's also a conservative state overall. And I guess in Palin is very favorable in some eyes of Texans, you know, because the way she, her style, you know, it's kind of like a chauffeur style, you know. So among Republicans, she's well looked on in Texas, I believe anyway.
I think you should set up a Texas talk show, you know, for on Blog Talk here for Texas politics. I think it'd be a fascinating hour or so, because a lot of people really don't understand Texas politics.
No, they don't. Texas has their own way of doing things. I mean, a lot of states, okay, when someone's executed, it's a big deal, right?
Okay.
I'm not sure it makes a big news. In Texas, it's lucky to get reported in the paper.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding you. One time I was on a Blog Talk show, and one guy said they executed someone, so I said, they did? It wasn't mentioned on local news. They didn't put, because I mean, it's kind of like, it's they'll have no problem if the person does the thing, okay, of executing the person. You know, they have no problem at all in Texas justice system. I mean, if you're doing wrong, okay, it doesn't matter what color you are, they'll do you. You know, the death penalty, and I'm in favor of it too. I mean,
but what I'm saying to you is that you should really start up a Texas politic program, and which would be fascinating, so people could understand the way that Texas people think, as opposed to people in the Northeast here. So and around the other.
I think people in the Northeast, okay, more so up, especially in the South, they feel how can I say it? More like this white guilt thing, you know? You know what I'm trying to say? More so than people in the South. Because I remember when the election was going down, and I was talking to people across on both sides, you know, and there were some people in the North, there's this feeling, okay, that like, well, you know, if we say the wrong thing, or we don't want to do this type thing, or, you know, or maybe we'll vote for that type thing, there was more of concern, right, you know? On Texas, like, we could care less, you know? That's the attitude. You know, it's like, as far as that particular thing there. And when that type of thing gets tried to get played, it really upsets people in Texas, you know, in a big way. So maybe it's just a culture thing, you know, probably that. But there's a different feeling because, yeah, they really, especially Republicans in power, they really have a hard time with the federal telling what to do, you know.
Right.
It really gets under the cry. And they have the power in Texas to basically do what they want to a point, you know, in that area.
Well, all the states do. That's the key.
Oh, yeah, they do, and that's the good thing about it.
And
but Texas, I think Texas will go with someone.
Yeah. So, I wish you good luck there in Texas, and call back again. I hope you get a show. Let me know if you do.
Maybe I will. You're the second person today has told me that. Well, I'll talk to you later. Okay. Have a nice one. You have an excellent show here. That was a very, very interesting interview, I think.
Oh, thank you very much. Okay. Good night.
Hey, bye.
Bye. Right, and that's the end of our program. I want to thank everybody for joining us, and please do so tomorrow night. On Thursday night, we discuss spirituality and more interesting arenas of interest. So have a good night. And Friday night, again, at 8 o'clock, join us here with George Dixon. So good night and have a pleasant day.